Testimony of Prophecy and History by Robert C. Newman, Biblical Theological Seminary. A brief abstract. The Jewish scriptures, we call the Old Testament, point to a promised individual called the Messiah, who is to come and rescue his people from oppression, bring in a golden age, make Israel a chief nation, rule humanity with justice for all, ensuring that all may live safely on their own property and enjoy the fruits of their labor. Christians think he has already come, and he is Jesus. Jews believe he hasn't come, but he will. He is certainly not Jesus. Secularists think the whole idea is wishful thinking. Who is right? We suggest that the evidence of biblical text and human history supports two propositions. If the Messiah has come, he is Jesus. And second, the Messiah has come. Let's see. The promised Messiah. According to the Hebrew Bible, this Messiah is to come and rescue his people from oppression. He's to bring in a golden age. He's to make Israel the chief nation and Jerusalem the world's capital. He's to rule humanity with justice for all and ensure that all may live in safety on their own property and enjoy the fruits of their labors. There are mixed opinions on this Messiah, however. Christians believe he has already come, but won't start the golden age until he returns. He is Jesus. Jews believe the Messiah has not yet come, but he will. He's not Jesus. Secularists believe that the Messiah is an empty hope, but we can occasionally expect great world leaders. Who's right? Does the evidence of biblical text and human history have anything to say about this? We suggest that it does. We suggest the evidence is substantial, and the evidence supports two propositions. If the Messiah has come, he is Jesus. And two, the Messiah has come. Let's see. If the Messiah has come, he is Jesus. We're going to look at these topics. A light to the nations, born yet preexistent, humble yet exalted, suffering yet reigning, king yet priest. So, let's look. A light to the nations. Two rather important passages in the servant section of the prophecy of Isaiah, that is Isaiah chapters 40 through 53, point to the Messiah being a light to the nations. The prophet says of the servant, actually is quoting God speaking to the servant, I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, that is Israel, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. Isaiah 42, 6 and 7. Further on, in Isaiah 49, verses 5 through 6, the prophet returns to that subject, and now he has the servant quoting his commission, if you like. And now, says the Lord, who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him, in order that Israel might be gathered to him. He says, it is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light to the nations, so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. A number of people have argued that the servant is Israel, but this passage, along with several others, clearly distinguishes the servant from Israel, and points out that this one will not only restore the Israelites, but he will also be a light to the nations, and here explains that is that by so my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Now, the interesting thing about these two passages is that they fit Jesus in a spectacular way. Of the many people claiming to be the Messiah, only Jesus has started a world religion of Gentiles. Before Jesus came, few non-Jews were believers in a single God, much less the God of the Bible. Now, nearly half the Gentiles in the world believe in the God of Abraham. The Bible also contains a number of paradoxes about this Messiah, and that these are strikingly fit in the picture that the New Testament gives us of Jesus. Let's look at each of them. One, the Messiah is to be born yet preexistent. We see this in Micah chapter 5, 2, where the prophet says, But you, Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come from me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. As an aside, I might mention this is one of the passages I don't much like the translation the NIV gives, which is what we're using here. They use Origins, and you see in the picture I've got it starred with two alternative translations, which I think are better, whose activities are from of old, or whose campaigns are from of old. The term is actually going out, or goings out, goings forth, etc., is I think the King James translation there. And if you look at the terminology used in the Old Testament, you'll see a phrase that's used fairly frequently for the activities of kings is they're going forth in the spring, which means they're going out to battle, to campaign. So suggest something in that direction. Well, our concern here in any case is that this names a particular Bethlehem, the one in Ephrata, that is the one south of Jerusalem. And although this is a small place, out of you will come for me, for God, one who will be ruler over Israel. So it's going to be the home of one who's to be ruler over Israel, and yet this ruler is also to have been pre-existent. He is to have pre-existed his coming from Bethlehem. We see something of the same thing in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, a very familiar messianic passage, where the prophet says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there'll be no end. He will reign upon David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever." Notice this is virtually a definition of Messiah, that he's going to reign on David's throne, and that he's going to have a eternal universal kingdom. Those are the features of a Messiah, if you like. We're explicitly told here that this person, this is a child who is born, and yet he's given these divine titles, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So a picture here, I think, we see from these two passages is Messiah will count Bethlehem as his hometown, even though he's existed for ages. That he'll be born, as explicitly stated by Isaiah, but he's also given the divine titles Mighty God and Everlasting Father. And this is neatly explained by the New Testament picture of Jesus, the eternal God who became human to pay for the sins of those who trust in him. So the New Testament model, if you like, of the Messiah, which is assigned to Jesus then, but the New Testament model solves this paradox. Another paradox, the coming of the Messiah, humble yet exalted. The exalted picture we see in Daniel chapter 7, 13 through 14, where Daniel has seen a vision of these four wild beasts that arise out of the sea, etc., and describes them in some detail. And our interpretation given later in the text is that these are successive kingdoms. And then he goes on to say, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Well, so here's a reference to a person called Son of Man, who approaches the Ancient of Days, approaches God, what Christians would call God the Father, and he receives an eternal, universal kingdom. Okay, so again, Messiah, though the term phrase Messiah is not used, it's not a real common term, actually, in the Old Testament. But a picture here that he has a coming on the clouds of heaven. Yet in Zechariah 9:9, we have this statement, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Well, here we see Israel's king coming and riding on a donkey. Pretty low-class transportation by Zechariah's time. Well, the Jews in Jesus' time were aware of these two alternative suggestions, and Jewish explanations typically were either to make the Zechariah coming more spectacular, that the donkey is a miraculous donkey of one sort or another. So we see in one passage in the rabbinic literature where I believe it's a Parthian king offers to one of the rabbis that he will lend the Messiah a horse so he can come on a horse. And the rabbi answers, do you have 100 colored horse? Meaning something like, wait till you see this donkey. That would be one alternative that was used. The other alternative was to make the comings in Daniel and Zechariah merely alternative possibilities. If Israel is worthy, then the Messiah will come on the clouds of heaven, says one of the rabbis. But if Israel is unworthy, then the Messiah will come lowly and riding upon a donkey. Now, that's a rather striking suggestion and has some truth to it, I think. Notice that the New Testament view fits this picture very nicely. Jesus comes first in humility, enters Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Jesus returns in exaltation, coming on the clouds of heaven. It also explains, the New Testament model also explains how the Messiah can come both as a child and an adult. A third paradox is that the Messiah will be both suffering and reigning. Several Old Testament passages picture one who is to suffer, whose suffering and deliverance become worldwide news. Some Jewish interpreters sought to explain these passages by means of a second Messiah figure, whom they called Messiah ben Joseph, Messiah son of Joseph. This figure was imagined to be a general who was to fight the wicked Gentile armies but be killed by them before Messiah ben David comes, Messiah son of David comes. However, we look at the suffering passages. The sufferer pictured in the Bible, Zechariah 12:10, is pierced by Israel rather than by the Gentiles. Doesn't fit that scheme at all. And although the lowly coming passage in Zechariah 9:9 might otherwise be assigned to this general, the donkey rider there is explicitly said to be king, and Messiah ben Joseph is not, because kingship has been restricted by God now to the descendants of David. The main suffering passage is Isaiah 53, actually beginning in Isaiah 52:13 and running the end of Isaiah 53, which is the climax of these servant passages we've made some reference to already that speak of the servant as a light to the Gentiles. Isaiah 53 marvelously fits Jesus. In Isaiah 53:3, we see that the servant there is despised and rejected, and Jesus is despised and rejected at his crucifixion. Isaiah 53:4 pictures the servant, suffering servant as considered under God's wrath by many, and certainly that would have been the view that many had at Jesus' crucifixion. The suffering servant is pictured in Isaiah 53:7 as strangely silent at his trial and execution, and that is definitely noticed in the accounts of Jesus' trial and execution. Isaiah 53:9 says that this suffering servant is intended to be thrown in a common grave with criminals, but he's buried in a rich man's tomb, and that is indeed exactly what happened with Jesus. Isaiah 53, verses 4, 5, 6, 8, and 10 point out that the death of the suffering servant was God's way of providing payment for our sins. And that's the biblical picture, the New Testament model of Jesus. In Isaiah 53:10-11, we're told that after his death, he prolongs his days. And the New Testament model has Jesus rising from the dead. And in Isaiah 52:15, we are told of the suffering servant, he will sprinkle many nations. Well, sprinkle is a standard term in the Old Testament for a cleansing ceremony. And indeed, the Christian picture of Jesus is that he is the one who will bring light to the nations, who will cleanse many nations by his atoning death. The striking thing about Isaiah 53 is that it not only marvelously fits Jesus, it is in fact the foundation of the atonement theology, or the picture that the Christian church gives of how Jesus saves people. It's the foundation of the gospel message of the church, if you like. Another paradox is that the Messiah is to be a king, yet a priest. The offices of king and priest were kept strictly separate in Israel's religion. A king, after Saul passed off the scene, had to be a descendant through the male line of David, and a priest had to be a descendant through the male line of Aaron. And since Aaron and David were not in the same line, it was not possible for a person to be simultaneously a descendant through the male line of David and a descendant through the male line of Aaron. And the offices of the king and priest were kept strictly separate in Israel's religion. And when King Uzziah tries to offer incense in the temple, something that the priests were alone supposed to do, he is struck with leprosy for trying to do that. So when priestly features show up in Messianic prophecy, it's not surprising that some people saw two messiahs, one of them a king and the other a priest. We see that sort of thing in the materials at Qumran, the perhaps Essene pictures of the messiahs. But a crucial passage in the Bible makes the one messiah both king and priest. That's this passage in Psalm 110, verses 2 and 4. The Lord, the psalmist says, will extend your mighty scepter from Zion. You will rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on the day on your day of battle. A kingly picture there. And then verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Because the kingship and priesthood were kept separate, the author of Psalm 110 must go all the way back to the book of Genesis and back to a Gentile to find a righteous priest-king, Melchizedek. But this fits the New Testament picture of Jesus. New Testament picture of Jesus. Jesus acted as a priest by offering a sacrifice for sins. In fact, offering himself as a sacrifice. And Jesus will return to rule as king forever, the standard sort of thing that the term Messiah, understood as a end times term, typically means. So, we suggest that if the Messiah has come, he is Jesus. Jesus has been a light to the nations, born yet preexistent, humble yet exalted, suffering yet reigning, king yet priest. But maybe the Messiah hasn't come yet. Jesus hasn't reigned yet. How do we know he will? Jesus hasn't returned yet. How do we know he will? Well, these are good questions. We don't want to make a mistake, erring in either direction, in thinking Jesus is the Messiah when he's not, or thinking Jesus is not the Messiah when he is. But we suggest that this question can be answered correctly by pointing out that the Messiah has come because certain time-oriented prophecies have expired in such a way as to point to Jesus. Let's have a look. First of all, the Messiah was to come while Judah had its own rulers. In Genesis 49:10, the patriarch Jacob is on his deathbed and is giving a prophetic last will and testament, if you like, to his grown sons. And he says something about each of the sons. And when he gets to his son Judah, he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. So here a picture of a coming king, and the scepter, the kingship presumably, will not depart from Judah until the one to whom it belongs comes. And he's the one who's going to rule the nations, okay? He's this king of the nations, such as, again, the typical definition of Messiah. Well, rulership comes to Judah some 500 years after the death of Jacob, around, well, it's actually more like 700 years after the death of Jacob, around 1000 B.C. Kingship remains in Judah and in David's family until 587 B.C., when the Babylonians destroy Jerusalem and carry off the Jews into Babylonian captivity. But then the Maccabees rule as kings of Judah from 103 B.C. to 63 B.C., and then Herod the Great rules as king of Judah from 40 B.C. to 4 B.C., and finally Herod Agrippa I rules from 41 to 44 AD. What we see here is that in one sense the scepter departed in 587 BC. And if we take this in that way, then we can say, oh, well, Christianity is false and we can go become Buddhists or something of that sort. But in another sense, the scepter didn't depart until 44 AD. It's kind of like saying, something about going to school, where it can be understood both in a repetitive sense, he goes to school every weekday during the school year, etc., and also in a broader sense, that person goes to school from grade 1 to whenever they finish their schooling, if you like, grade 12 or finishing college or something of that sort. Mm. Well, that's what we're suggesting here, that the scepter departed for a while in 587 BC, but resumed three times after that, and in this other sense it departed in 44 AD, and there has been no king of Judah since 44 AD. This suggests that the Messiah must have come before 44 AD. Well, Jesus came and was crucified about 30 AD. Secondly, the Messiah was to come while a second temple stood. As the Jews returned from exile are standing around looking at the foundation of the temple in Jerusalem that they have now relaid the foundation and are just getting ready to build the temple, the prophet Haggai says in Haggai chapter 2, verses 3 through 9, "Who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing?" So there were a few older people around who had seen the previous temple, and that was impressive, Solomon's temple, and this one must seem like virtually nothing. But then God goes on to say, "The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty, and in this place I will grant peace." Well, the term glory here is ambiguous. Sometimes in the Bible it's used for wealth. Sometimes it's used for God's presence. The second temple did not look like much when Haggai and his associates were standing there looking at the foundations. But near the end of the history of the second temple, completed about 515 BC and destroyed in 70 AD, near the end of its time, Herod the Great enlarged the temple surroundings, the courts, and greatly upgraded the appearance of the temple and such. And so the second temple may have surpassed Solomon's temple in wealth at the time of Herod. We really don't know for sure. We don't know enough about the details of Solomon's temple. We've got a good bit of detail on Herod's temple. We do know that the second temple lacked the Ark of the Covenant, the box in which the Ten Commandments and the clay and the pot of manna and such were kept. We do know that the temple lacked the Ark of the Covenant, and we do know that the second temple lacked the glory cloud. My suggestion is only if the second temple was visited by the Messiah did it surpass the first temple in this kind of presence of God glory. Well, the second temple was destroyed in AD 70. So if the Messiah came before AD 70, then this prophecy would be satisfied. Thirdly, the Messiah was to come after the 69th Sabbath cycle. Daniel in Persia is an officer of the rulers there, and he realizes that the captivity of the Israelites has lasted nearly 70 years, and that was predicted for the length of time of the captivity in the prophecies of Jeremiah. And so he begins to pray to God and confess his own sins and those of his people. And we're told by Daniel that an angel comes and appears to him with a message. And part of that message is this: no one understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, that's the Messiah, comes, there'll be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It, Jerusalem, will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing So here we have a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. We have a time of the coming of the Anointed One. We have some numbers given for that. We have the rebuilding of the city, and we have the cutting off of the Anointed One. Well, the unit of time measurement in this prophecy appears to be cycles of sabbatical years. The term used to translate sevens in that particular version is traditionally translated weeks in the King James, and yet it has, although it's the same word that's used for weeks of days, it's used with an unusual plural, and we understand from some of the Intertestament books that this particular plural was used for the seven-year sabbatical cycles in which the land and the agricultural land in Israel was to be planted for 6 years and to be left fallow for the seventh or sabbatical year. The unit of time measurement here appears to be cycles of sabbatical years. The starting point seems to be the command of King Artaxerxes I in his 20th year, 445 BC, in which he allows Nehemiah to go back and rebuild the walls and gates of Jerusalem so that Jerusalem ceases to be just a village and becomes a city again. As the ancient distinction between city and village is more that of fortification than it is of the size of the population. The sabbatical cycle in which this particular command falls is the cycle that starts in the fall of 449 BC and runs to the fall of 442 BC. Using the usual inclusive method of counting, that is the method in which the time units you are using for counting some interval of the first unit is the unit in which the starting point takes place, and the last unit is the unit in which the end point occurs, and the inclusive method then is you count this unit that the starting point is in as the first unit, so it's the inclusive method of counting. Using the usual inclusive method of counting, the 69th cycle is 28 to 35 AD. Here's what it looks like in a chart, with the blue bars representing the Sabbath, the 7 year Sabbath cycles, and we're counting them. The starting point is Artaxerxes' decree in 445, that's the black arrow. And Jesus' crucifixion, 30 AD, falls right in that 69th cycle, 28 to 35 AD. We suggest then that the Messiah has come. He was to come while Judah had its own rulers before 44 AD. He was to come while the second temple still stood before 70 AD. He was to come and be cut off after the 69th sabbatical cycle, that is, after 28 AD. Well, this fits Jesus. Jesus' ministry started perhaps around 26 to 27 AD, and he was crucified around 30 AD. Some put it as early as 29, and some put it as late as 33. But all of them fall in that particular range. The Messiah was to come while Judah had its own rulers before 44 AD, to come while the second temple still stood before 70 AD, to come and be cut off after the 69th sabbatical cycle, after 28 AD. Jesus was cut off. Jesus fits these prophecies, and Jesus is the only messianic claimant who has started a world religion of Gentiles. Conclusions? If the Messiah has come, he is Jesus. The Messiah has come, he is Jesus. May we think about how that applies to what life is all about and what we need to do about it.